You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening. I'm Marie Nair. I'm very glad to welcome you here to listen to and talk to Alex Borain, who has recently published an autobiographical work, A Life in Transition. If you haven't had a chance to read it, I recommend it highly. It's not only a good story about a fascinating life and a life that has involved a great many momentous matters, but it is, in a way, a history of South Africa, certainly during the last half century or so, or perhaps somewhat longer than that. And of course, it also includes the establishment of the International Center for Transitional Justice and some of the early work of that institution. Alex, at various times, has been a churchman, that is, the president of the Methodist Church of Southern Africa. He's been a member of parliament in South Africa for the Progressive Federal Party during the apartheid period, and then a resigned member of parliament, a founder and executive director of IDASA, the Institute for a Democratic Alternative for South Africa. He then led a project on justice in transition in South Africa that paved the way for the establishment of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. He then served as the deputy chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and that was before becoming the founding head of the International Center for Transitional Justice. And Alex hasn't exactly sort of retired at this stage. He's busy now trying to save South Africa, and also has some engagement in what is taking place in Zimbabwe. So I'm not sure what parts of all this he proposes to talk about, but I'm eager to hear what Alex has to say. Alex?
Thank you very much indeed. In a previous book, I described Arie Nair as my mentor. I'm not always sure that he was pleased about that or would own up to that, but it remains the truth. And it's quite a delight for me, really, to be at OSI and to participate in a discussion on matters which are important not only for the part of the world that I come from, but also in your own country or here in the United States. There are many similar challenges which I think you know a lot about. It's good to see some real good friends, familiar faces. Thank you for coming, all of you, and I hope that we can have a time for questions and discussion, which of course is by far the best way to communicate. What I propose to do is to say just something about the book, why I wrote it and what it's about, and then to fast forward, if you like, and talk a little bit about what's happening in South Africa and in Zimbabwe. It's very difficult to do that because things happen at such a rapid rate that by the time I'm finished speaking, I probably will be out of date again. Anyway, the title, A Life in Transition, captures, I think, the sort of life that I've lived for quite a while, There have been so many transitions, and Arya has referred to many of them. My first real university study was very much theology and philosophy, and very active in the church in South Africa, which was strategically placed in terms of the challenge of apartheid, pernicious system of racism, seldom equaled anywhere else, apart perhaps from the United States for a while, and not so much today. But it was, I think, the impact of what was happening politically in my own country, which led me out of the church and indirectly into politics. I think I have to say that the set of values which came to me through my time in working in theology and philosophy have stood well in my whole approach to the whole question of justice. And it seemed to me the place to be in South Africa was to confront the leaders of the apartheid regime face-to-face rather than from a distance. And that drove me into politics and into parliamentary politics, which was an extremely difficult decision to take. This was an all-white parliament. Should I have been there? What was it about? I depended on the only people who could vote were white people. So here I was protesting against apartheid, but in an apartheid institution. It was a very difficult decision to have made. But for me, looking back, I think it was the right one. I think there needed to be a voice. I think the problem was not a black one, it was a white one. And therefore you needed some whites to stand up and to make that clear. And I talk about that quite a lot in the book, this whole tension in being part of the institution and yet standing over against it and reaching a point where I simply couldn't stay there any longer and had to walk out of Parliament and move much more into civil society. It was a fascinating time in South Africa, fascinating and also very difficult. One state of emergency after another, thousands of people in jail, harassment at every turn, and to start an institute for a democratic alternative was a bit tricky, but it's amazing how it took off. Within a few years, we had over 100 people working for that institute, with 6 offices all over South Africa. And the main thrust, and I describe this at, again, some length in the book, was to work towards negotiation politics. We knew well the politics of repression, and we knew well the politics of resistance. And now it seemed to some of us that what we needed was for people who were killing each other to find a space and a place where they could sit and talk and discuss and find another alternative, very much the politics of negotiations, which were very messy, as negotiations almost inevitably are. Lots of compromises, and I hope I have the time to, not tonight, but to focus a little more clearly on the compromises that were made and whether they ought to have been made in order to move towards a fragile democracy and a commitment to the rule of law. I was in IDASA for about 7 years, I think, and then because of the negotiations that were now successfully taking place, and the meetings we had all over the country and outside of the country, particularly with the ANC leadership in exile, I think may have made a small contribution towards the possibility of negotiation politics. Those negotiations lasted for 4 years. Well, there was an enormous amount of violence during that period of time, and it was, you didn't quite know if it was going to be on or off. And one moment it was, next moment it wasn't. So it was a very, very difficult time. But it seemed to me that when we had our first democratic election ever in our history, in 1994, that the negotiations were taking place in amongst the elite, very understandably. They were the leaders of these factions. But what about the millions of people who had sweltered under the yoke of apartheid for so long? How does one deal with that past? How do you take that and renew something which was close to death? And I started to start thinking about the possibility of a model that could be used to do that. And that's when I met Arianaya, and I remember over breakfast. Lots of things happen over breakfast, don't they? This was in Budapest, not in New York. And he said to me, you've been to Germany and to Poland and to Czech Republic, and you've looked at a lot of these places, but I think you must go to Argentina, and I think you must go to Chile, and you must go to Uruguay, and Guatemala, all over the place. And I said, that's fantastic, yes. So I left IDASA and started a little thing called Justice in Transition. Very small. But the total budget was met by OSI. So yet again, enormous indebtedness and in large measure because of Arias' personal commitment. And we started the preparations for that. It was probably the most novel of all truth commissions that we have seen. Very different, very extensive, very ambitious. And I suppose that the impact of South Africa's model has been felt in many, many parts of the world. Although, let me make it very clear, and I make that clear in the book, that you simply can't take the South African model and impose that on any other country, let alone countries. But I'm fascinated, but, you know, it's 10, 11, 12 years ago. And so what do? I have 2 weeks ago, I was meeting with a delegation of judges and lawyers from Nigeria, who wanted to know more about the South African model because they were going to introduce something similar. And then a week later, a group of people from Kenya, where they're going to have a truth commission, and they wanted to come. And I keep saying to them, you can't take the South African model. It must be sui generis. It must arise out of your own situation. And yes, of course, best practices. Some things that we did were good, but we made many mistakes. And perhaps people can learn more from our mistakes. And I list those in the book. When I wrote an earlier book, I was perhaps too close to it. Now with distance, I could afford to be, I think, a lot more critical. And we failed in a number of ways in the South African experience, but it also had a very, very considerable impact on our life there. And when I thought that my days of transition were virtually over, the work of the Truth Commission was completed, and I thought that I could sort of sit back a little bit and write. And then I got this incredible invitation from New York University asking if I would come as a fellow initially to the university, to the law school. That was an amazing experience. I describe that again because whilst I was there, I was asked by the then dean, John Sexton, who some of you will know, who is now president of NYU, if I would write a proposal to introduce a new course of study at the law school. Now, this is incredible because, I mean, you know, A, I'm not a trained lawyer. Second, you know, I was 69 years old. And here I was in yet another transition. But I did it. And I wrote this out. And actually, I'm really quite proud of the fact that NYU Law School was the first ever law school to introduce a course of study on transitional justice over two semesters. And that was great. So I did that, and then they asked if I would stay and teach it. So I did that as well, and which I thought, this is great. What a way to end my career. This is a great transition. One of the things that flowed directly from the South African Truth Commission was that because it was the first commission to be held in public and open, therefore, to television and radio, there were many, many people from around the world that came to see what was happening and invited some of us to go back to their countries to see if some of the work we were doing made some sense in their own transitions. And when I was in New York, I tried at a lecture, and Ari and I was there, and so was Juan Mendez and quite a few other people, try to talk about the need for another organization, a new organization, which would try to meet the needs of countries in transition. An incredible moment of opportunity, but an incredible moment of challenge as well, because things can go very, very badly wrong when the new is yet is to be born and the old is not dead. And as a consequence of that, Susan Beresford, who was present at that little workshop, she said, well, why isn't there an organization doing this? And I said, well, I think this is, you know, new thinking perhaps, or perhaps there are people that are doing something, but I think we need one that will focus particularly on the question of how do you achieve justice in times of transition. She was so committed to this that she, at Ford Foundation, asked if we would write a proposal, which we did. She liked it. And as a direct result of that, the International Center for Transitional Justice was born. And I thought again, well, that's fantastic. It's now seen the light of day. I can go back to Cape Town. But she said she would only give the money if I stayed. And that's how I became the founding president of ICTJ. Yet another time of transition. I'm so happy that Juan Mendez is here because he is the current president, and under his leadership and those around him, ICTJ has grown phenomenally. I talk about that in the book, but it's amazing the number of countries, 24, 25, that the center is involved in. The number of offices that we have opened all over. The staff must be around about 135, if I'm not, probably another one since I last saw you earlier today. But so the growth has been fantastic. And it was just such a great honor and privilege to be part of the beginnings of that work and to be now the chairman of the board and therefore still involved in some way. ICTJ, I think, tried to focus on a holistic approach to justice, and tried perhaps to focus on the creation of a just society rather than simply focusing on justice. There is a difference, I think. And incorporated in that was this great emphasis on accountability, which is still one of the hallmarks of the work that we do, but also on truth delivery, of coming to terms with the past, owning up, acknowledgement, and knowledge, and also the whole question of a society that perhaps has been crushed under oppression or in violence and dictatorship. How do they cope with that? How do they get a new deal, a square deal? So the whole question of changing institutions is so vital, not just about an individual, but of an institution and institutions and reparations for those who suffered so much under that particular regime, whichever country we are talking about. And as a result of that, flowing from that, the possibility in deeply divided societies to bring about a measure of yes, of healing, of reconciliation. And I don't talk about something cheap, which is just words. I'm talking about something very much different from that, and I try to spell it out in one of the chapters in the book. Now, what I'd like to do, and I've already been talking too long, is to fast forward and to say, well, okay, you're now back in Cape Town, and you're chairman of the board, and so you're involved. But what's happening in South Africa? Well, momentous things are happening. I thought, you know, wow, now we can relax. The democracy is there. A fine, brilliant constitutional court, a commitment to the rule of law, to the rights and the respect of people. So much that we had worked for, struggled for, fought for, is now at risk and in great peril. What has happened, which has happened so often in so many societies, is that power corrupts. And in the African National Congress, a political party that I voted for on two occasions, so it's not a question of just simply criticizing them, there is at the heart and the center of that corruption and greed. And a deliberate, I think, turning away from respect for the courts, for the judiciary, for the rule of law. And centered on a man by the name of Jacob Zuma, who faces very, very far-reaching and serious charges and has spent a lot of time and great deal of taxpayers' money in trying to make sure that he doesn't be answerable in a court of law for those serious charges. And I accept that he is guilty until proven, he's innocent. Freudian slip there, eh? So I concede that, and I concede that the National Prosecuting Authority has been remiss, sloppy in its work, but the recent events which led to the sacking of Thabo Mbeki, who had it coming in many ways. His own presidency was very badly flawed, but it's a very dangerous precedent for a political party to force the resignation of a president of a state, of a country. The boundaries between the political party and the parliament of the country, that boundary has been crossed, and that's very, very dangerous indeed. If they felt that he had transgressed in any serious way, then you could go the route of impeachment, or you could go and put huge pressure in order to bring about an earlier election. But to sack him and then to bring in somebody else on a temporary basis until Zuma can take over, to me is nothing short of trying to avoid Zuma facing the charges, which are, as I say, extremely serious. So what is at the heart of the problem in South Africa then is not whether Thabo Mbeki was a good president or not so good president or a bad president, but what is wrong is that, in my view, the ANC as a dominant political force with nearly 70% of the vote has lost its soul. It's lost its way. It's not just losing the plot. And that's very serious indeed, because that means that because they have so much power, that South Africa itself is in danger of losing its soul, to use that phrase. And by that I mean a shifting away from a commitment to the judiciary, to the rule of law, to the freedom of the press. All the great freedoms that we've fought for so hard, I really do think they are in trouble. So, yet another transition. I'm involved in two things at the moment. One is an attempt to set up a committee to defend the Constitution. We have a magnificent Constitution, but it's in danger. So what some of us are trying to do is to establish, if you like, a bulwark in order to challenge this very powerful political force to adhere to the Constitution. That'll be very public. It won't be very popular, but it's very necessary. And there's a wide cross-section of us that are working on that. The second is, and this is much more controversial, I have sort of felt that perhaps the time is right for a new political party to emerge in South Africa. And because of the demographics, and just because of the rightness of all, that party would have to be led by a black woman or a black man, obviously. The present opposition parties are small, they're fractured. There's no way that somebody who is disenchanted with the ANC will go to one of those parties very readily, very easily. The ANC is nearly 100 years old. It has tradition, it has music, it has dance, it has politics, it has history. And people see it as part of their family rather than just a membership of a political party. So in order to persuade people, and I know this is happening, that there are good people within the ANC who are crying into their drinks at night because of what's happening to the party. But there's no time for that. The time is for them to step out into the open and to take a stand and be counted as for those who are for democracy and are for justice and for the rule of law. And it may be that there ought to be a new vehicle which will be a place where you can attract people from the ANC and from outside of the ANC who don't know what to do. And you know, we have an election next year, May. People are saying, well, I'm just not going to vote. I don't know who to vote for. I can't vote for them anymore. I used to. But when you think of the people who died and struggled to enable people to have the franchise, You can't simply say, I'm not going to vote because I don't like this candidate or I like that party. It's got to be used in some way. Well, you can spoil the paper and write funny things on it or rude things, whatever you like. But that's not good enough. The situation is far more serious than that. So what do you do? It may be that this shift away from this colossus can come about when there is a vehicle where they feel that they can find a home. So, as I say, it's very controversial. I'm going to quote, and I'm very nearly at the end, so don't despair. I want to quote from something I've just written, and it will be published in a magazine called Leadership in South Africa, and I just want to read a few words. I talk about the backdrop that I've described, Becky's sacking and the shift and the change and a new president. Is this simply a matter of getting even, of settling scores? Or is it about ensuring that Zuma doesn't face the serious charges and the allegations which the National Prosecuting Authority has brought against him? It's also about a house divided. The ANC has lost its way, its once proud record going back nearly 100 years is tarnished by internal strife, entitlement, greed, corruption, jobs for pals, and inefficiencies at almost every level of government. The moral compass has been buried, and instead we have a party that's drifting away from principle to authoritarianism and dogmatism. And as Eric Hoffer put it so well, every great cause begins as a movement, becomes a business, and eventually degenerates into a racket. And I think that describes the situation right now. So life continues to be in transition, and so that will be something that we can be involved in. Zimbabwe is a tragic situation. Again, corruption, power. Mugabe, whom I've met on a number of occasions, not recently. He won't meet me anymore. But here was a man who actually did rather well to begin with. And I think a lot of us felt that there's hope here. But then, of course, he was challenged. And this is a typical response of a dictator. You're okay as long as you do it. What you want them to do, but the moment they are challenged on that referendum which he lost, he immediately used the land question, which is a very serious question in Zimbabwe and needs massive attention. But he used that as an opportunity to take far greater power into himself. Elections were corrupt, the harassment, the killing of people, the desperate hunger of hundreds and thousands of people. You know the story. You've read about it. You don't need me to go in. I talk about it in the book as well, both in the South Africa and the Zimbabwean, right up till May of this year. And now we have a deal. And I think in part the deal is there because Mbeki saw the writing on the wall and realized that he wasn't going to be around as president very much longer. So he left his somewhat pedestrian way and decided to sort of put huge, huge pressure on both Mugabe and Tsvangirai. And they finally signed that deal. But it's a deal which is so flawed, particularly in terms of the absence of any accountability. On the contrary, it seems to me, and the reading of that, to allow people to get off the hook entirely. You're dealing here with people who have blood on their hands, as one of my colleagues in ICJ put it recently in a public statement. Now, what do you do? Tsvangirai was being criticized by saying he's holding out for too much. You've got to realize that you've got to give in negotiations. You can't just take. But he was right to hold out. And whether history will prove him right or wrong in having signed that agreement, right now, an hour ago, my friend and colleague told me that he heard from Harare that the deadlock is still there, that Mugabe is insisting that he retains the powerful positions in the military and in the police, in finance, and one other, what was the other one? Yeah, local government. So, you know, I don't know whether, negotiations go on and on. Sometimes miracles do happen. Sometimes the pressure is overwhelming. But the donors will not come to rescue Zimbabwe until they know that there is a genuine sharing of power. So I belong to an organization called IDASM, which is trying to cope with some of that work. So is ICTJ, so is IDASA. There are a lot of organizations, and in particular, organizations inside of Zimbabwe, which is where, of course, it really has to happen. So life in transition goes on, and next week I'll return to South Africa and again to Zimbabwe. And I hope that those of you who care about that part of the world will not give up. I know you have a few problems of your own. Just a few, but who knows, they may be resolved, some of them, in a short while. Let's hope so. Thank you.